Private sector job growth is the best it's been in 3 years.
But for those who've been out of work for a long time, things just got worse.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hello from American Public Media. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, the first day of December. Coming up, we're going to dig into the reports that Google is about to buy Groupon for $6 billion. And we've got a tale of someone whose life was literally saved by overtime pay.
But first, let's get to the good and the bad news on the job front and the analysis of Richard DeKayser, chief economist at the Parthenon Group. He's with us now from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the payroll company ADP says in November, the private sector added the most jobs since November of 2007. Is that as good as it sounds?
You know, Jeremy, I think it is, and a couple of reasons. Analysts are really focused on what the government's going to tell us happened in November. That number comes out on Friday, but the ADP payroll report is the single best predictor of that. So to see a number as high as it has been is very encouraging. Secondly, though, ADP has been running low of the government's figures to a substantial degree over the past year, falling short in 11 of the past 12 months, and on average by about 90,000. So it's quite possible we could see an even stronger figure from the government.
Now, Richard, also on the job front, Congress did not extend the unemployment benefits for some 2 million or so people who are going to start to lose their federal assistance as of today. These are people who have been collecting unemployment for a long time, almost 2 years. A lot of them probably won't be getting their old jobs back. What's going to happen to this chunk of the population that just can't find jobs?
Well, first, I think it's important to appreciate how big a deal this is. You know, the last time the unemployment rate was where it is today, back in the 80s, the average week of duration of unemployment was about 12 weeks. Now it's 20. So there's a lot of folks, and there's basically three options. They will leave the labor force, they will stay unemployed, or they will find alternatives. And which of those three is going to depend entirely on how well the economy is doing.
All right. Richard DeKayser, economist at the Parthenon Group. Thanks, as always, for your time.
My pleasure.
Today in Washington, a Senate committee will look into bare-bones health insurance policies that cover nearly 1.5 million workers all over the country. They're called mini-med plans, and they offer limited coverage. Well, today, senators will be asking whether that coverage is a little too limited. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has that story.
Mini-med plans are usually offered by companies that pay low wages. They cover a limited number of doctor visits or cap maximum payouts anywhere between $1,000 to $10,000 a year. Stephen Finan of the American Cancer Society says mini-med plans are inadequate.
They're junk plans, but they have the pretense of being real insurance when they're not.
But employers who buy mini-med plans say they're not supposed to be comprehensive. They're a cheap alternative. And Devin Herrick at the National Center for Policy Analysis says many low-wage workers prefer limited annual payouts to high-deductible plans. Those plans only cover catastrophic illnesses.
A lot of your moderate-income workers didn't really like those because those didn't offer them quick access to day-to-day medical care.
Mini-med plans will disappear when health reform kicks in 2014. In the meantime, Congress is considering raising their minimum coverage even earlier. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Under an order from Congress, the Federal Reserve today will post on the web the names of companies that received emergency aid at the height of the economic abyss. That aid, by the way, totaled more than $3 trillion. Marketplace's Gregory Warner is with us from Philadelphia with the latest. Good morning, Gregory.
Good morning, Steve.
So when this list goes public here in just a few hours, what are we going to find out that we didn't already know?
Well, so this is a chance for the public to see, for the first time, a comprehensive list of all the companies that received central bank support during the crisis. And we're talking about big banks as well as private companies like General Electric. So I talked to two people this morning. First, Bill Buesenberg at the Center for Public Integrity. And you remember, he used to work for American Public Media. Anyway, Buesenberg says this sends a message.
If you're going to get a bailout from the government, you should expect that that should be public and people should see it and know about it.
So then I talked to Ted Truman. He's a former Fed economist now at the Peterson Institute. He says transparency isn't always a good thing, especially when you're talking about banks that have reasons not to let the public know that they're in trouble.
If every time someone who is in trouble and needs a little bit of help, right, their name is going to appear in the New York Times, they're going to hesitate before they go there. That will, in fact, exacerbate the next crisis.
Okay, but Gregory, besides being wonky gossip for Wall Street types, who's paying attention to this stuff?
Well, this is politics, and the Federal Reserve is under greater political scrutiny than it's been in three decades. There's sure to be a lot of public second guessing today, whatever names the Fed reveals today on the web.
Gregory, thanks. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Marketplace's Gregory Warner in Philadelphia.
Well, Steve, I've already gotten a Groupon deal in my email inbox today. No. It's half-price Spanish cuisine and drinks at some restaurant downtown.
Yeah, mine I got this morning, Jeremy. It was a half-off whale watching in Orange County.
Is it warm enough out there right
no,
now to
no,
go
it's,
whale
it's
watching?
It's freezing outside, as a matter of fact, here on the West Coast.
Well, it is here, too. All right. Well, that simple business model, those deals that get emailed to us, are all about getting groups of people to buy something at a discount. And that business model is apparently really attractive to Google.
Yeah, there are reports this morning Google's going to spend nearly $6 billion to buy Groupon. But is it really worth that much? Let's start our coverage with this report and Marketplace's Jennifer Collins.
They go by names like Buy With Me or Tipper. In the UK, there's something called Groupola.
Groupola finds fun and exciting activities in your area and presents a daily deal to you and your friends.
Most of these sites organize groups of people to buy deals available for only a short time, say a half-priced oil change. Ken Doctor is a media analyst for Outsell.
There are going to be a lot of people trying to sell coupons, and there's only one or two of these networks are going to work.
So sites are trying to distinguish themselves to stay in business. For instance, if you get three of your friends to buy a discounted hotel room on livingsocial.com, you get to stay for free. But Barry Liebert, author of the book Social Nation, says these companies are still basically distributors of coupons.
I don't think those are sustainable models in the social network world without a dedicated community.
He says the sites will need to work harder to keep their customers hooked, or at least find a better way to reward loyalty. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
For more now on the possible Google Groupon deal, let's bring in Henry Blodgett. He's CEO of the website Business Insider. He's with me here in our New York studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So what does Google see in a company like Groupon?
Google sees a huge new growth engine. Google's core business, search, is starting to mature. They are looking for another business that can drive it going forward. Groupon is one of the fastest growing companies in history, $500 million in revenue in its second or third year. So they see a huge opportunity there.
Is this about being a social network like Facebook?
No, Groupon really has nothing to do with social networking. What it does is local advertising, which Google has been trying to crack. And Groupon effectively has invented a whole new form of classified advertising, which Google thinks it could now go into.
Is Google worried that one of its competitors would pick up Groupon if it didn't?
Yes, Google is often motivated by competitive fronts. But I think the main motivation here is to, again, find a new big growth engine. Google has cash coming out of its ears, so even a huge price tag like the one we're talking about here isn't that big a deal for Google.
Henry Blodgett, you were at the center of a well-documented scandal that has you now banned from the securities industry. I don't want to get into that beyond saying that you know what it's like to get it both right and wrong on tech companies. How does Google know that it's right about the valuation of this thing?
Well, there's no way that they can know that they're right. Groupon's had an incredible start. Again, $500 million in real revenue. It's not a hallucination. It's not based on eyeballs. But what you have to remember is Google has $33 billion in cash on the balance sheet. It's generating $2 billion a quarter. It can afford to make a big bet like this, even if it doesn't work.
Okay, finally, I looked and Groupon, which apparently is worth many billions of dollars, only has 3,000 employees. With all of this big growth in Silicon Valley, are we getting anything out of it in the economy if we're not getting that many jobs?
I think you have to look at it reverse. 3 years ago, Groupon didn't exist, and now it employs 3,000 people worldwide. That's pretty extraordinary. It's hard to see that in any other industry. So I think what's going on in the tech industry is actually very beneficial for both the economy psychologically and in reality.
Henry Blodgett, CEO and editor-in-chief of Business Insider, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, the first day of December. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us here in the United States. Just days after Ireland received a bailout from the European Union, the debt crisis in Europe is getting worse, not better. The U.S. is sending a top Treasury Department official across the Atlantic for talks, and there are now concerns not just about weaker European economies like Spain and Portugal, but about the stronger economies, too. Christopher Wirth has more now from London.
Countries like Italy and even Belgium weren't considered immediate risks until just recently. Now, investors are worried even those countries might have trouble paying back their debts. And it doesn't stop there. Yields on German bonds have even risen slightly. Evidence there's even some fear over Germany, and it's the strongest economy in Europe. But to calm markets, European leaders may be trying some deja vu all over again. They're planning another round of European bank stress tests. Graham Turner of BGC Economics says that was already tried around the time that Greece was bailed out earlier this year.
Lo and behold, here we are in November, December, and some of the banks that passed the stress tests have run into trouble. So stress tests simply won't do the trick.
Turner says he isn't too excited about another financial do-over Europe may try. Reports say the European Central Bank may resort to buying up bonds, much like the U.S. Federal Reserve announced it would do last month. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
The United Nations Climate Conference in Cancun is now underway. No one's expecting earth-shaking news coming out of there. But there is this. A major economic power wants to back out of the world's only legally binding climate change treaty. Marketplace's Eve Tro is in Cancun, and she has more. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning.
So who's backing out? What's going on there?
Well, on opening day here, Japan drew a line in the sand. It will not support extending the Kyoto Protocol. And that's the treaty that expires in 2012, where developed countries agreed to reduce greenhouse gases, with the glaring exception of the U.S., which never signed. Japan says if the U.S. and developing nations, like China, haven't promised to cut pollution, then the Kyoto Treaty isn't fair. Why should Japan keep taking an economic hit to reduce emissions while those countries don't have to do anything?
So even is Japan the only one turning its back on Kyoto?
Other countries have done so for years. They just didn't say so publicly. Canada and Russia signed, but they pretty much blew off their Kyoto promises and kept polluting. And globally, greenhouse gases have only gone down a tiny bit, if at all, under Kyoto. But it's been a kind of backup plan. Without it, there'd be more weight behind the other global plan on the table, the Copenhagen Accord. That's the voluntary agreement signed by 80 countries last year to reduce pollution. And some want to turn Copenhagen into law. But if Copenhagen stays voluntary, and Kyoto fails, that could mean there's no United Nations law for any country to lower greenhouse gases.
Now, Eve, Kyoto is in Japan, obviously.
Yes.
Isn't it a bit embarrassing for Japan to strike against a treaty that was signed on its own home turf?
Yeah, one expert I talked to said that might be the only thing that keeps Japan in this treaty. You know, headlines that say Japan kills Kyoto might just be too much to bear.
We'll see. All right. Marketplace's Eve Tro in Cancun. Eve, thanks.
Thank you.
For years, U.S. companies have complained the Chinese government looks the other way when vendors pirate American goods. We're talking about clothes and software, among other things. Well, this week, Beijing unveiled details about a new crackdown on intellectual property theft. And American lawyers say they believe that the Chinese government may actually be for real this time. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports.
The image of bulldozers crushing pirated DVDs is a familiar one in China. State-run news rolls these images whenever China's government takes heat for condoning rampant piracy. We're seeing these images again this week, but there's something new this time, says intellectual property lawyer Douglas Clark.
In the past, you take the case to the police and they're very busy, or unless it's a perfect case, they're not interested. This time around, they're actually specifically asking for cases to be brought to them, and they appear keen to follow up.
Why the sudden concern? Beijing is spending billions on another campaign to spur Chinese tech companies to innovate.
I'm sure the authorities have been getting the message back from Chinese companies saying, if you want to innovate, you've got to protect our IP rights.
Street vendors aren't shaking in their fake Gucci boots yet. As of today, they were still selling all four seasons of Mad Men on DVD for less than $10. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, December 1st. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org.
Well, as we said, no one expects any major international agreements to emerge from that UN climate summit in Cancun. But stalled talks in climate policy at the international level haven't stopped some communities here at home from tackling the problem in all sorts of ways. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill profiles a small town of Sandpoint, Idaho.
Sandpoint is a transition town, which means it's part of an international movement of communities with a big goal, preparing for life after cheap oil and climate change. But here in Idaho, one of the reddest states there is, the members of the Sandpoint Transition Initiative don't talk about it that way.
Sandpoint's a very diverse community here in North Idaho. We have everybody from hippies to right-wingers. And so when you start using words like sustainability or environmental, then people start getting angry.
John Reuter is the city council president in this 8,000-person town. He's a Republican. He and the Democratic mayor are not part of the Sandpoint Transition Initiative, but both support its projects. One of the group's leaders, Karen Lanfer, says it's important that the group not use language that's divisive or political, instead framing changes as good for people and the community.
And we have to find a way to shift the paradigm so that we start talking to each other in a really respectful and civil manner. And I think we're modeling that.
There's a folk school where people learn from their elders rather than, say, learning the skills they might need if society shuts down. And there's a community garden, a place to grow community, a place for kids to play, rather than learn how to make their own food in case one day they can't bring it from other parts of the world.
People would have just said, oh, just another, you know, ratty-haired liberal. I'm not going to listen to her. Why should I bother? No.
That garden off two busy roads in the middle of town is sparse this time of year. But Transition Initiative member Pat Wentworth says it's bustling in summertime and the idea is spreading.
People have come up to me and said, I started my own garden at home because we saw what was happening here.
That takeaway, that germination of a small idea to something bigger, seems to be an important part of what small communities can do to take on climate change, even if they never, ever say those words. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
The future of the Triple Crown is in question this week. Maryland's Preakness Stakes is the second of three of the country's most famous thoroughbred horse races. A battle between track operators and horse owners means next year's race may not get out of the gate. From Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The 135th running of the Preakness, and they're off.
The Preakness brings tens of millions of dollars into the Maryland economy every year, but next year's event is on hold because of a dispute over the racing schedule at the state's two main thoroughbred tracks. The track's owners say they can't afford to host more than 47 days of live racing at Laurel Park and Pimlico next year. This year, they'll host 146 days. Lou Ullman is chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission. It nixed the shorter schedule.
We felt that that would be the death knell of the Maryland racing industry. We've got about 10,000 jobs statewide in this industry, and running 17 days of live racing at Laurel and 30 days at Pimlico would not be sufficient to keep all these people employed.
The track's owners didn't return calls. Gaming analyst James Carmel says the companies are struggling to compete with tracks in neighboring states. They support horse racing with revenue from slot machines and video lottery terminals. Efforts to bring slots to Maryland's Laurel Park have failed so far.
Actually operating a live racing schedule is a losing proposition, so the less they do of it, you might say, the better off they are financially.
Carmel says it's too soon to worry about the fate of the Preakness. He says track owners could come back with another plan. Some have even suggested the state seize the tracks to save the middle jewel of the Triple Crown. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, this is a tale of a kind-hearted commuter in your neck of the woods in New York who rescued a fellow New Yorker in a busy subway tunnel. You may have heard of this on Sunday.
I love these stories. They happen occasionally.
They
but
do.
Yes,
they do, absolutely. Okay, go ahead. Carlos Flores leapt onto the 600-volt electrified rail line after a man passed out and fell several feet down onto the tracks. Now, that's a steep drop, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And of course, the transit authority says, don't go down there.
Right.
It's not the place to be. You can get electrocuted
third rail.
For one thing.
Yeah.
That's right, the third rail. So he sounds like a good Samaritan, right?
Oh, definitely.
And he is. But the only thing on Carlos Flores' mind was his job. This is what he told the New York Daily News. He says if the man had gotten hit, there would have been this huge delay, and he wouldn't have been able to get to work and get paid.
So, oh, boy.
And it was even more important to get to that job because on Sunday, this happened on a Sunday, he says pay is time and a half.
Oh, well, you know, in this economy, maybe you can't blame him, Steve. I mean, he did jump onto the tracks and save the guy.
Get those trains moving, man, so he could get to work. You can't blame
Absolutely.
Him.
Well, here in New York and above ground and not on the subway tracks, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles, where we have few trains that take commuters from one place
not
to another.
Not much of a subway there,
no, there's
right?
not. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.